Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Todd Ensign, Director of Citizen Soldier, who examines the Pentagon's growing demand for troops and the debate on reinstituting a military draft. Former Marine Staff Sergeant Jimmy Massey, who discusses his grave concern about how the U.S. has conducted the war in Iraq, and former conservative activist David Brock, who takes a critical look at corporate media's coverage of the presidential election campaign. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
At the 2003 G8 summit in Evian, France, President George W. Bush issued a private challenge to several European leaders. If they would donate $1 billion to a joint AIDS fund, the United States would match it. Yet Bush only requested Congress to give $200 million for the United Nations-sponsored Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. But the Republican-led Congress placed over $500 million in the Global Fund budget line, yet in the 2005 budget, Bush again only asked for $200 million for the AIDS fund. According to the American Prospect magazine, Bush has a consistent pattern of failing to deliver on promises to combat global AIDS. Instead of backing the UN AIDS Fund, Bush created his own unilateral five-year program, but the administration only allocated $2 billion in 2003, most of which was not spent until February 2004, leaving tens of thousands of sick Africans without access to AIDS drugs. African leaders worry that Bush's AIDS program is restricting funds to critically needed HIV prevention programs and limiting condom distribution to what they determine to be high-risk groups. Critics of the Bush initiative also complain that money has been set aside for U.S. evangelical groups with no experience in Africa. As a result, secular groups like the African Service Committee, which sends outreach workers into urban areas in Ethiopia, are denied U.S. funding. After months of indecision on September 30th, Russia, a major oil producer, moved to ratify the Kyoto Protocol to combat global warming. Russia's vote was needed to put the Kyoto Agreement, first crafted in 1997, into effect. The treaty required nations responsible for producing 55% of greenhouse gases to endorse the accord. The Russian Duma, or parliament, must still ratify the treaty. The United States, the largest global warming polluter, pulled out of the Global Environmental Accord in 2001. The treaty calls for industrial nations to cut greenhouse gases 5.2% below their 1990 levels. Yet Russia will not face any short-term economic pain from Kyoto because the nation's emissions have already fallen 30% since 1990 due to an economic and industrial depression that has gripped post-Soviet nations. According to Reuters, Russian President Putin's push for ratification was designed to gain favor with the European Union, the main backer of the Kyoto Protocol, and get its help to gain admission to the World Trade Organization. As a spokesperson from the group Friends of the Earth told the BBC, Russia's endorsement will increase the pressure on countries like the U.S. and Australia, who have so far remained outside the only international agreement to curb greenhouse gas emissions. On the campaign stump, George W. Bush likes to take credit for what he calls the liberation of the women of Afghanistan by deposing the Taliban regime in late 2001. While girls can now go to school, they still live in a repressive Muslim society, where a woman's main value is to be attached to a man and where teenage girls are commonly sold into marriage. Take the case of the Herati shelter girls. According to The Nation magazine, 26 young women came to the attention of United Nations refugee workers in 2003. They were being forced to live in a guest house in western Afghanistan under the protective custody of notorious warlord Ismail Khan. Each of the young women had grown up in exile in neighboring Iran. By circumstance, they had worked for pimps or drug runners and later picked up by the local police. Soon thereafter, they were handed over to an Afghan border official, a relative of Khan, until recently the warlord of Afghanistan's Herat province. The UN investigation found evidence of beatings by guards, fighting among the young women, and several suicide attempts. The UN Refugee Agency pressured Khan to release the women, but their troubles did not end there. They were turned over to Shanada, an aid group run by Dr. Seema Samar, the first Afghan Minister of Women's Affairs. The girls went to a new shelter, but again were forced to live in close quarters guarded by men. In frustration, Dr. Samar sent some of the women away to get trained as nurses, and for the rest she put out the word they were available for arranged marriage. Yet one of the newly married shelter girls was recently beaten by her husband and his brother. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Zelfia Hunter.
As the war in Iraq continues, U.S. occupation forces have stepped up attacks on cities controlled by insurgents in places like Samarra and Fallujah. The number of American soldiers killed in the war has now risen to more than 1,060, while the estimated number of Iraqi civilians killed ranges up to 15,000. In the midst of the ongoing conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, reports are coming in which confirm that the U.S. military is stretched thin. The Army National Guard failed this year to meet its recruitment goal, reenlistment is down, stop-loss orders have extended thousands of soldiers' tours of duty, and in recent months, one-third of ready reservists refused to report for service. These are among the signs which suggest the military's all-volunteer system, in place since the end of the draft in 1973, may not be able to produce enough soldiers for the Pentagon. Representative Charles Rangel, a Democrat from New York, has proposed federal legislation that would require military conscription or alternative national service for all young adults. Rangel believes that if those calling for war knew that their children were more likely to be placed in harm's way, they would be more cautious about leading the nation into battle. While Rangel's measure has not been seriously addressed in Congress, there is growing debate about how the Pentagon will make up the shortfall of soldiers to fight current and future wars. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Todd Ensign, director of Citizen Soldier, who discusses the possibility that a draft could, in the near future, be reinstituted for young men and women.
You have to look at why we instituted the all-volunteer force. And we instituted that back in 73, a lot of your listeners will recall, really because they realized that the opposition to the war had grown to a very intense level. And in fact, one of the architects of that program, Milton Friedman, the famous Nobel laureate economist, he said in talks with the commission that set it up, he said, you know, if we can get rid of the draft, we can remove most of the opposition to the Vietnam War. And so the logic I'm following is that that's the same thing today. They believe that by keeping the draft and military obligation out of the, shall we say, white middle class community, they can insulate most of society from the effects of the war. And I really believe that's their cynical point of view about it. They don't want to alarm, you know, the broad middle class about what this war will cost in the future. And so I believe that they'll do everything they can. This, to me, is Kerry as well as Bush. They will both do everything they can to keep from reinstituting any sort of conscription. Now, if there are new military demands that are made after November, or shall we say soon, I think then they'll be forced to go to a draft. One thing listeners should realize is this is not going to be a draft like we had in the Vietnam era. The first thing that's different is women will definitely be included. All Congress has to do is require women to register. They can do that in 5 minutes. If they do that, women will be part of the draft right along with men. And the second thing they plan to do is they want to get rid of all these deferments and all the battling that went on back in the 60s. And so there'll be no deferments. If you're in college, it doesn't matter. You still will serve your time. So that will have an enormous impact if they do that on the society. And some people like Rangel, the congressman you mentioned, that's what he believes. He says, let's let the whole society feel the weight of these wars. If we're going to rush into them, let everyone share the burden.
What kind of support do you think there is for a draft within Congress, given the problems that occurred in the Vietnam War era, where you had a lot of protests driven by people expecting that they would be drafted if the war or the draft wasn't ended before their number came up?
Well, that's a good question. At the present time, I think there are only about 10 or 12 sponsors of Rangel's proposal, which would reinstitute the draft. So obviously it has almost no support. I think the only sponsor in the Senate is Ernest Hollings, the guy who introduced it from South Carolina. So there is no public support right now for a draft in either branch of Congress. And, of course, neither Kerry nor Bush dare breathe a word about the dreaded D word. In fact, they both have said they're against it. And Kerry said that he would rule it out now. He would commit to not doing it. But as I said, we're talking about hard numbers here and shortages. You mentioned earlier the recruiting and retention. They claim, actually, that they've been able to meet most all of their recruiting goals for this latest fiscal year, with the exception of the reserves. And there they say they're falling about 10% short. But if you'll also notice the other day, there was a big story in the New York Times saying that all of a sudden they're going to lower the educational requirement. It used to be that 90% of all people had to be high school graduates. Now they're changing that to 92%. Then it could be raised to 94%. In other words, at some point you can get more people in just by lowering the standards of entry.
How do you think the issue of the draft sort of looming out there, even though it's not been discussed much by the politicians or the news media, how do you think that's going to affect the vote in what could be a very close presidential election?
Well, as I said, both Kerry and Bush pretty much hold to the same position. That is that the draft is not on the agenda. The reinstitution of the draft is not something that either of them supports. I mean, although obviously voters are smart enough to know that these kinds of campaign statements don't necessarily have any binding force. I mean, if in November Bush, reelected Bush, is told that we just are not going to be able to keep deploying the troops we need to Iraq and to all the other countries we send them to without a draft, then he will go before Congress. And they'll start heating up the support for it. You know, remember, it's been 35 years since people have seen conscription. A whole generation and a half of people have no idea what it means to have someone send you a notice saying, next week you report to such and such an army base and we're going to swear you in and put a uniform on you and make you train. So it's, frankly, a very foreign experience to America's youth today. I personally believe there will be major rebellion. I think there'll be massive resistance to it. I really mean that, and I think that Bush and Kerry both, I think, fear the same thing. But remember, Kerry has been very clear. He's for staying there. He stayed a course. We must establish stability. We must establish freedom, whatever that is over there. And Kerry is just as dogged and determined as Bush. And in fact, in some ways, he seems even more conservative on it than Bush. So both of them are tied to staying there. They've got to have a certain number of people to do it. If they can't get the bodies voluntarily, then they're going to have to make some hard decisions. I think it will probably tear the country apart. But that's not necessarily a bad thing if it's over such an odious policy.
That was Todd Ensign, director of Citizen Soldier and author of America's Military Today, The Challenge of Militarism. Contact Citizen Soldier by calling area code 212-679-2250 or visit their website at www.citizen-soldier.org. A few months ago, 8 U.S. veterans of the Iraq War, including 2 women, founded Iraq Veterans Against the War. The group is calling for an immediate U.S. withdrawal from Iraq and full funding for veterans' benefits at home. The organization, with support from Vietnam Veterans Against the War and Veterans for Peace, is open to any active duty, reservist, or recent veteran of U.S. operations in Iraq. Members of the group are on a nationwide speaking tour. One of them, Jimmy Massey, spoke in late September at an event in New Haven, Connecticut. Massey was a Marine Staff Sergeant with 12 years of service. After participating in the invasion of Iraq in March 2003, he began speaking out against the killing of civilians. He came to see himself as a war criminal and suffered severe depression. He was honorably discharged in December 2003. The following are excerpts from Jimmy Massey's talk, recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. The Kia incident he mentions is a reference to one of many actions in which U.S. soldiers and Marines killed Iraqi civilians.
I was pretty disturbed at what I was seeing and what I was witnessing. But, you know, in the Marine Corps, there's no room for that type of ideology on the battlefield. I didn't know what to think. I didn't know what to do. I knew that I had violated just about every law of war and every Geneva Convention. So what do you do? I suppressed it. I said, yeah, well, I'm a killer. This is what I get paid to do. You know, this is the coup de grace. I mean, this is it. You know, this is 12 years of training, and this is war. But I couldn't accept that. You know, when you see a dying child, or you see an old lady that's got a bullet wound to the head, you know something's not right. That's not the enemy. So everything came to a head. I slowly became depressed over about a 2-week period. It was seriously affecting my judgment, my job, my performance. My commanding officer, right after the Kia incident, we pulled into the Baghdad Stadium, and we basically turned the Baghdad Stadium into a fortress. He came up to me and he goes, "What's wrong, Cesar?" And I said, "Well, today was not a good day. We killed a lot of innocent civilians." And he said, "No, today's a good day." At that point, I knew I was in the wrong place. You know, a lot of my critics say, "Well, you know, what did you expect? What were you? Were you bottle fed? Did your mom not give you enough attention?" I mean, these are all things that has been said to me. But what I say to those people is, when is enough enough? You know, didn't we learn our lesson from Vietnam? I mean, we tried Nazi Germany's in World War II for atrocities that we were committing. I mean, it comes down to humanity. It comes down to either say something or shut up. Are you going to sell your soul, or are you going to have a soul? And that's how I looked at it. I've always been taught, you know, the difference between right and wrong. I grew up single mom. My father passed away when I was young. My mom was very strict on me. It's her ideology that's gotten me here where I'm at now. You know, taking an innocent life, you just can't hide. And you can't hide it from the Iraqis. These people, these innocent civilians that we killed, they have family. And there were Iraqis that saw the brutality that the American Marines were doing over there. They saw it. They witnessed it. So what do you say to them? You know, how do you tell a 25-year-old Iraqi, "Hey, sorry, you know, your uncle or your brother or your sister was just in the wrong place at the wrong time"? What is that, war? I mean, you know, that was the excuses. These are things that was given to me. And I'm looking, I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. That ain't right. Even in war, you're held accountable for your actions. You're held accountable, me as a staff sergeant, all the way up to the President of the United States. And especially since we tried Nazi war criminals and we led the way with the humanity on the battlefield with the Geneva Conventions. Where did we go wrong? I'm 32 years old. When I went to the Marine Corps, if they would have told me 12 years from now, you're going to be up speaking in a group of people about the atrocities that you committed in Iraq, I'd say, "Hey, whoa, partner, that ain't me." I don't know why it happened. All I know is every day I live with it. And every day I ask my government, to you, the citizens, to ask your government why it happened, or to ask your representatives why it happened. And all of this is true. Because if it wasn't true, they would have had every reporter from every agency within the U.S. government coming down and saying, "Staff Sergeant Massey, this guy's a wacko," or whatever. CNN has even done an investigation on this. They actually talked to members of my platoon, and members of my platoon came back and said, yeah, we killed civilians, but if you think I'm going to apologize for it, I'm not. And then CNN came back and said, "Oops, sorry. Hey, this is way too controversial for me." We're not touching it. This is how I look at it. Imagine you being married for 30 years, loving, happy relationship. You've got kids together. You wake up one morning, say it's on your 30th anniversary. your wife rolls over at you or your spouse rolls over at you and says, you know what, everything I've ever told you, everything that we've ever done is all a lie. I never loved you. And by the way, the kids ain't yours either. That's how I feel.
That was Jimmy Massey of Iraq Veterans Against the War speaking in New Haven, Connecticut on September 23rd. Visit the group's website at www.ivaw.net or contact them via email at ivaw@ivaw.net. Since the first of three presidential debates, which many say resulted in a decisive victory for Senator John Kerry, the election campaign has tightened, indicated by a virtual tie in many post-debate public opinion polls. But even as the nation prepares to watch the remaining presidential debates and one matchup between the vice presidential candidates, the media's initial coverage and post-debate spin are critical in consolidating public perception of winners and losers. But what role has the corporate media played in covering this year's election campaign? Many critics point to the endless media focus on the president's and Mr. Kerry's Vietnam-era military service record, with less attention paid to the more immediate issues of the ongoing war in Iraq and a troubled economy here at home. Although conservative activists have long charged that the nation's major media reported the news with a liberal bias, the public at large in recent years has come to feel that big media companies have a decided conservative slant. David Brock is a former conservative activist who broke with the right in the late 1990s and went on to write an insider's account of his work targeting the Clinton presidency in the book Blinded by the Right, The Conscience of an Ex-Conservative. Brock went on to establish the MediaMatters.org website, which monitors the media for conservative misinformation. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Brock about the problems he sees and how the media has covered this year's election campaign, much of which is discussed in his group's new book, Misstating the State of the Union.
You have the media reluctant to point out what it knows to be true, what it knows to be factual, under this notion of balance or objectivity, where they feel like they have to give both sides equal weight, even if they know that one side is not correct. And I think that's the result of a lot of different things, but one of the things certainly is years of conservative, organizational, and very orchestrated and well-financed pressure on the media to push it to the right, to push it to accommodating conservatism, to chill it and intimidate it. And that has its effects. It's pretty much commonly recognized at this point that the media didn't do a very good job reporting on the entire time of the run-up to the war in Iraq. The New York Times has admitted in a pretty lengthy mea culpa that they were not aggressive enough in questioning the administration's rationale. For example, one of the things we write about in this new book, Misstating the State of the Union, is a continual assertion that the reason we have a budget deficit is because of 9/11. But if you really look at what the Congressional Budget Office found, they found that the budget had gone into deficit in August 2001 before the 9/11 attacks. But the media often doesn't point out that second piece of it, even though the information's available. So that's a key point. The other part, I think, is that just as a former conservative, just as an observation I would make, I do think that Democrats, generally speaking, still don't quite understand the ability of the right wing and of the conservative movement to distort things in their direction. And so I think sometimes candidates can be blindsided by these types of attacks.
David, I wanted to ask you briefly about this first debate between George W. Bush and Senator John Kerry. It seems that for the most part, America and even the press are pretty clear that John Kerry was successful in establishing himself as a credible presidential figure and the winner of the debate as seen by America. But I wanted to ask you about the post-debate spin. It seems that the Republicans, the Bush administration, have clearly chosen the phrase global test taken out of context from one of the responses by Senator Kerry to really call into question his commitment to acting on America's behalf without first getting a vote of the United Nations or the international community at large. And they're going at this full tilt. They have ads on TV already. It's the very disciplined talking point of all the Republican activists. Tell us a little bit how you see this playing out, given your experience within this Republican political machine.
Well, I think the Republicans were a bit thrown off their game in terms of how to spin the debate, because Kerry had turned in a strong performance. He really didn't give the critics very much to work with, and Bush had turned in a notably weak performance. But it didn't take them very long, as you noted, to pull something out of the debate that they could then try to turn around and turn to their advantage. And the full context of the quote where Senator Kerry talks about a global test also talks about his statement that if he felt it was the right thing to do, that nothing would stop the United States from taking preemptive action. That's the part they leave out. And unfortunately, ads are going to exaggerate, embellish, or leave things out of context. But the thing that's not excusable is to have the free media also reporting the global test remark without providing the full context. In the current issue of Newsweek, they accept the Bush assertion global test and never provide the rest of the Kerry quote. We have probably close to a half dozen examples of conservative pundits, Cato Byrne, Bill O'Reilly, leaving the context out. And that's one thing. I suppose you expect that they're going to distort at this point and put out the best face for the Bush administration. But when you see it seeping into media that we depend on to really do an accurate job, that's where the conservatism seeps into the regular media coverage, and that's the kind of thing that hopefully by pointing this out, well, that's what we're trying to guard against, and we're trying to bring the media back to a position where it has the independence and the authority and the confidence, really, to do what it should be doing, which is trying to get at some truth. You know, I mean, that's kind of an old-fashioned notion at this point in the press. They want to leave it as one side says the earth is round and the other says it's flat, and then that's the end of the story, you know? That's really not the job of the media, I don't think.
That was David Brock, a former conservative activist who now works to expose right-wing media bias. Visit his website at www.mediamatters.org. His latest book is titled Misstating the State of the Union, Right-Wing Media Distortions About the Clinton and Bush Presidencies. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and Real Audio. There, you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Zofia Hunter, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.